in 3, 2, 1. Hi, this is Tim Grierson.
And hi, this is Will Leach. And this is the Grierson and Leach podcast, episode 24. Well, we are Grierson and Leach on the New Republic. You can find us on Twitter at Grierson Leach. And please subscribe to us on iTunes. Give us a nice review. And we'll review whatever movie you want us to talk about on this podcast. If you've noticed a somewhat abrupt tone, like I'm just speeding through here, it's because we have a lot to cover in this episode. Specifically, this is an episode I've been looking forward to doing for a while now. It is our best films of the first half of 2016. We do this every year because a lot of times, particularly by the Academy, movies from the first half of the year are forgotten a little bit. We always try to stop halfway through the year and both mention our six best movies of the year. So now, Grierson, I don't know your top six. Actually, I know one of your top six because of an editing accident. But otherwise, I don't know any of your top six, and you do not know my top six, correct?
That is correct.
We both have guesses, of course.
We have guesses, yes.
But we have been avoiding this link and avoiding. We even filed our top six separately to our editor to make sure that we did not know to save it for this particular podcast. So, Grierson, I don't want to waste any time. Let's just dig in.
Okay.
We're each going to give one. We'll start alphabetically. These are not ranked because we do that for the end of the year. First on my list in alphabetical order is Everybody Wants Some! ! Directed by Richard Linklater. Of course, it is follow-up to Boyhood. But it was funny when he gave interviews about the movie. He talked about how it was a spiritual successor to Dazed and Confused, or spiritual sequel. And while I think that's actually a pretty good way to put it, like it's not any of the same characters, but it generally has that same kind of vibe of capturing this particular moment in time. And it feels in a lot of ways. All of his movies are personal. This is not like an impersonal filmmaker. But this feels like a particularly personal moment. Almost his personal remembrances. But more to the point, everyone, it is just a classic hang-around movie. This is just a fantastic hang out with these really enjoyable people and have a great time with the movie. It's certainly a little bro-heavy, to say the least. I think that's part of the point. And I think that some people weren't able to get past that. But I feel like this is perfect, cool, chill Richard Linklater as absolute best. I absolutely love this movie.
Yes, this is in my top six of the first half of the year as well.
A match.
Yeah, and I agree with everything that you just said, except for I actually wondered if describing it as, and I actually wrote spiritual sequel in my little write-up that we both did, if that actually hurt the movie commercially, because people thought, wait, this isn't the same characters as that movie. So I don't understand like how this is a follow-up to Dazed and Confused. I think this movie stands alone just fine on its own. You don't need to have seen Dazed and Confused. It's been years and years since I've seen it, and you don't need to see that movie to appreciate this movie fully. I'll talk about it more in a bit, but yeah, I totally agree. I think this movie is really, really great.
Okay, so it's on your list, but it's not first alphabetically.
My first alphabetically is one of two films that I saw at Cannes last year. That's a hint for you, Will. The first movie on my list alphabetically is Cemetery of Splendor, the new film from Thai director Api Chop Pong Weerasthakul.
Or Joe.
Or Joe, as he is fond of being called. Yeah, this movie is much like his earlier movies, like Uncle Boonmay, who can recall his past lives, and Syndromes in a Century, where describing its plot is basically a waste of time because it's not really about much of a story. It's more about being put into a mood and to an atmosphere. The story of this film is that an older woman takes it upon herself to basically watch over a group of local soldiers who all have the same illness. They have this sleeping sickness where they can't wake up. They're in this like comatose state. That's essentially the setup for the movie. And then what happens from there, it kind of goes in all these different directions. Joe is a filmmaker who makes movies that really need to be experienced on the big screen, which is very difficult because his movies get very little audience outside of like LA, New York, and Chicago. But they're just these beautiful creations. I find all of his movies really, really, really absorbing. This one, I think, especially is that way. There's political sort of undertones to this movie. There are certain issues about generational divides in this film. They're beautiful and lovely and poignant. But for me, all of his films are about an experience. And when his movies are over, I find it very difficult to go back into the real world because he really transports you into this place that he creates.
Okay, I have seen Cemetery Splendor, and one of my only real, frankly, you brought up a pretty excellent, important thing there. You really need to see these movies on the big screen. And I've seen Uncle Boonmi, I've seen this, and I didn't see either one of them on the big screen, and it loses it. It loses that spell. It's funny, you talk about a movie being slow. The Turin Horse was your favorite movie from a couple of years ago, and I've like had some gentle fun with you. I call it the movie that Tim loves about with the guy that looks out the window for 20 minutes. And that's, of course, it's better than that, and I'm being facetious, and I'm just having some fun with that. But I do find, even though this is the same kind of like slow cinema kind of idea, I find these movies more warmer than that movie. I find there's just a general sense of good cheer. There's a sense of play and fun in his movies that I think clearly comes across. It didn't make my list. He's obviously a filmmaker you like more than I do, but it's a movie that I wish I could get in the spell that you were on these movies, but nevertheless, I have no bad feeling toward this movie or his movies at all in particular.
Yeah, I think that's actually a great point that his movies are very like restorative, and I find them to be very kind of like playful is a good way of putting it, but they're also just kind of refreshing in terms of there's something about them that feels like I'm not someone who goes to a spa or does those types of things, but that way I hear the way people describe those type of restorative experiences is what his movies do for me. He is, to compare him to Bellatar in terms of different types of international filmmakers, you know, people like Bellatar are very much more like severe and austere in terms of the way their movies are punishing and demanding. Joe's films are much more light. They have a light touch to them. So in that way, my hope would be that there'd be a little more kind of easy to get into than maybe the certain other filmmakers were like, oh God, I'm not sure if I can sit through 2.5 hours of that. So you do your second one now.
My second is The Lobster. The Lobster, directed by Yorgos Lanthimos. I reviewed this for The New Republic, starring Colin Farrell. Briefly, John C. Reilly. Basically, the Lobster is a kind of a dystopia, alternative reality time to now, where in the general kind of looniness of everything that Lanthimos sort of does, this is about a future society where people, if they are not cut off in 45 days, I think that's right,
45 days.
They are turned into an animal of their choosing, hence the eponymous lobster.
Now, the fact that you'll turn into an animal if you fail to fall in love with someone during your stay here is not something that should upset you or get you down. Now, have you thought of what animal you'd like to be if you end up alone?
Yes, a lobster.
I feel like people, it is a love story, but it's certainly an interesting sort of love story. One of the things you talked about that, because I talked most of them, we talked about this earlier, about how funny it was. I just think the movie is just so deadpan. It's this incredible scene where they're dancing to electronic music in the forest that just makes me laugh every time I think about it. But I also, and one of the things you talked about, I think is really key to what makes this movie's work. It just keeps going off in different directions. It's not a movie at any point where you can fathom what it's going to do next. And it keeps you on your toes in this very exciting way. I still like Dogtooth a little bit more, but I like this movie quite a bit. It's obviously in my top six. So The Lobster.
This is also on my list.
Yeah, two crossover match. Quit copying me.
This is the other movie I saw from Cannes last year that made my list. And yeah, it's I totally sign off on everything that you said.
Good.
For me, what's funny is for people who don't know Lanthimos's films, in recommending this to certain people, and realizing Dogtooth prepares you for this, but having certain people come back to me and say, you didn't tell me how violent and disturbing that movie was.
Right, right.
It is shocking in certain moments, but it's funny how, or perhaps upsetting if you know me, that I don't think about that. Though there are these really incredibly shocking, violent moments, because I think he's prepared us in certain ways to know that that's part of his MO. So if you haven't seen The Lobster and you've heard this really, this funny, sharp satire about modern day romance, that's all true. But also, there are some shocking moments. We probably should prepare people for that.
Yeah, it's fine. Nothing like the tooth scene in Dogtooth, but nevertheless, some pretty creepy stuff.
The only thing I'll just add right now is that Farrell is just so tremendous. We talked about this at the original podcast when we reviewed it. Farrell is so good. I'm so glad that, you know, as opposed to Everybody Wants Some, that I feel like has kind of gotten lost. people found the lobster, and kudos to A24 rescuing that movie after another distributor picked it up at Cannes, and they knew exactly how to market that movie, and it's found its audience, and I'm really, really happy about that.
All right, so that's there's two of mine, The Lobster. What's next on your list in alphabetical order?
Next up for me is Everybody Wants Some!
Exclamation point, yes.
I'm sad this movie has not found its audience, and I'm frankly kind of disappointed that certain critics have sort of decided that this is the movie that they're going to turn on Linklater about. I don't agree with the idea that this movie is just about a bunch of horny dudes, like straight white dudes and their straight white dude problems, because I see those movies a lot.
Like every weekend.
Yeah, I go to Sundance. I see those movies over and over and over again. I think what Linklater does, I think if this was the first movie Linklater had made, perhaps you could make that argument. But I think that what Linklater has done consistently throughout his career is, yes, he does tell the story of, you know, thoughtful white dudes in America with somewhat conventional issues and problems, but he elevates them in such a way where, to me, to use this movie as an example, it's impossible to watch this film and not start to pick up eventually, oh, there's a commentary going on at the same time. And the thing that I wrote about when I review for us for the New Republic is specifically this idea of that time is always happening at that moment, as they say at the end of Boyhood, it's always right now, but that there's something very fleeting about that, and it's not going to last. And for the first, I can't think of a movie in recent memory where it's a movie has so captured that sense of the present being so present, and also an idea that they are in a bubble, and that bubble is going to end at some point. It's about a group of hotshot college baseball players, and most of them know they're not going to be professional ball players, and that this is going to end, and that they don't know what that period is afterwards. And I think that understanding informs everything that you see in this movie, because it is about guys who are living on borrowed time. This movie to me is immensely moving. I find it incredibly touching. And so for me, some of the reviews I've read about people who just sort of dismiss it, I really feel like they're not looking closely enough at this movie. It's filled with great performances, including the one-time kid who is in Road to Perdition, who's fantastic in this, as we talked about on that podcast. I feel like I know some of these guys. I grew up with some of these guys. I don't know if you felt that way, Will, since we kind of grew up together.
Yeah. Maybe that's, I mean, most of them were you.
It's true.
No, it's not true at all.
It's true. The amount of horn dog kind of shenanigans I got in high school is just amazing. Yeah, I feel a real kinship to this movie. I feel protective of this movie in a certain way. I'm hoping people will sort of rediscover it. I think a movie like this is exactly the value of doing what we're doing, which is to tell people, hey, there are good movies in the first half of the year. Please check these out.
It is out on, you can see it. It's on iTunes, it's out on DVD. You can certainly rent it. We encourage everyone to do it. You will not be disappointed. All right. My third movie on my list is Louder Than Bombs.
Pew,
Louder
pew.
Than Bombs. Pew, 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 pew. That is, of course, by Joachim Trier. He made a movie that you know how much I love. Also, August 31st, which came out a few years ago. This was his English language debut. It stars Jesse Eisenberg and Gabriel Byrne, Devin Druid, and Isabel Huppert. Isabel Huppert is the mother she's a well-known war photographer who dies in a car accident, or maybe has killed herself. The movie's never entirely clear about that. And it's about how the family, her husband, Gabriel Byrne, and her two sons, Eisenberg and Druid, are still kind of dealing with the ramifications of her death and kind of their own issues as well. The movie is told in kind of this disjointed narrative fashion in a way that is always very clear. I don't remember ever liking Gabriel Byrne as much as I like him in this movie. He's so good in this movie. He's this husband who has not only lost his wife, but is raising this teenager and also dealing with learning more about his wife after she's died. It also gets, as someone that travels a lot for work and has a family, it really is incredibly wise about the notion of when you are gone for a while and then you come back and the rest of the family is actually just functioning just fine without you, and everyone's happy to see you, but you're still this weird distance. I think the movie is shot really wise, but this is a movie that feels like it was based on this best-selling book, this deep, thick, rich novel, and it's not.
I'm glad to hear that because I don't know if you've seen this, had seen this yet before we did this list. I'm really glad that you like this. I do too. And the sequence that you're talking about specifically about with Isabelle Huppert talking, doing a voiceover essentially about what it's like to be a war photographer, be away in a very dangerous part of the world, and then to come back home, which one would think, oh, you're home, that's so great, you're reconnecting with your family, and how that's its own kind of like war zone in a way. That sequence is absolutely tremendous. And if you watch that movie at a film festival like I did, you could almost hear a palpable groan of recognition from the audience.
Yes.
You went, yes, yes, we understand what you mean.
Did it make your list?
It did not make my list.
Oh, you monster.
It's a B+ for me, but I like this movie a lot as well. I've seen it twice now. And when it played Cannes last year, I have to tell you that one of the things I had to hear about over and over and over again was, gee, it's such a disappointment that after Trier made these two really good films, his English language debut is kind of a conventional, dysfunctional family, death in the family movie. And I said, well, if that's the case, look how much better and smarter this movie is than that type of movie normally is. Because in a lot of other hands, this is your typical fall for your consideration, big, heavy emoting, really sentimental, big fireworks all the time kind of thing. And Trier doesn't do that. This movie, when it opened in the U.S., opened right after Batman vs. Superman came out. And it was a great reminder at that time of, don't worry, everybody, Jesse Eisenberg is still a good actor, because I think he is tremendous in this movie.
He's as good in this as he is bad in that movie.
Yeah, he's really, really good. And I think when people talk about like the really good Eisenberg performances, this is the one they're probably going to forget because nobody saw this movie. For people who haven't seen it, I don't want to ruin this. The final resolution with the girl in his class that he really likes, I think is much better and much smarter. And also, I think much more sympathetic and humane than people give that moment credit for. I think
I was really worried that plot line throughout the movie. I was like, oh, they better pay that. Like, don't pay this off the way every other movie does. And then it doesn't. It was very reassuring.
Yeah. And I think all of Trier's films, you know, you talk about it being this one feeling very novelistic. I feel like all of his movies have done that. They all feel like, wait, what's this? What's the book that this is based on? Oh, it's based on nothing. I think he's a really gifted filmmaker. And I think also in terms of the flashback structure, what you talk about, watching it, especially the second time when I really kind of got wrapped up in, is that number one, I couldn't see the seams of, oh, now this is where these flashbacks are going to occur. It didn't unravel for me. It still felt as mysterious. And I think that's part of the idea, which is that those flashbacks are the different characters' memories of the mother. And it's amazing to see how each character responds to the mother, to the Huppert character, based on their own experience. It's not like Rashomon exactly, but there is a sense that when you watch them, that you shouldn't necessarily trust all of those flashbacks, because it's all of how that individual thinks about the woman who's not there anymore in the family. It's really good. I said it didn't make my list, but I really highly encourage people to check it out. I think it's, in terms of movies that just got buried and just got completely forgotten about, this is one of those ones.
Excellent. All right, what's next on your list?
Okay, third on my list is The Lobster.
Sure, okay, we don't need to get into too much more about that.
The only thing I'll add to it is that this is maybe one of my favorite Rachel Weisz performances. She's so great in this. She's really, really good. And Lea Seydoux is so damn funny in this movie. She's really, really terrific. Olivia Colman's in it. It's just a really good cast. And I want to reiterate one thing that we talked about from the original podcast when we reviewed this, which is, this is Lanthimos' first English language film, and this movie is all about tone and language,
yeah. Mm-hmm.
And he hits it so well that to me that's even more impressive than everything else in this movie, beyond the fact that it's not just a one joke, like, see, relationships are tough. Like, it's much smarter than that, but also to get a whole cast together and sort of have them be all of a piece in terms of how they execute this is really, really, really impressive. So yes, The Lobster is also on my list.
So we're halfway through each of our lists. Now we go to my fourth. Remember, we're not ranking these. These are in alphabetical order. My next movie is Midnight Special.
Dad, it's okay.
It stars Michael Shannon. Michael Shannon has this son who is gifted in a way that the movie is... mets out information about what exactly how he is gifted, and then actually withholds some other information. And to me, that's one of the key things that makes this movie really great is how it mets out that information, how it trusts the audience to tell its story. These are the very similar themes that Nichols has made in some of his other movies. The idea of how to deal with a gifted child, the pressures and terrors of being a parent in a terrifying world. I still think his movies, it's funny, get after everyone, everybody wants some, !! I feel like Nichols has done a lot better with female characters in previous movies than he does here. There's still some gray areas in it, but I feel like it's on the whole, it's very moving and very well done. It's very ambitious. So the fact that it's pulled off like that is a pretty excellent achievement. So I've got Midnight Special on my list.
This movie just missed my list. And for me, and that was actually surprising because when I made my list initially, I assumed it was going to make the list. There's just been a lot of stuff I really liked this year, but I also really like this movie. I'm mad this movie did not find its audience because, again, if we want studios to put out movies that aren't just sequels and blockbusters, these are those movies, and if people don't go to see them, what's the point? It's so great to have Michael Shannon back in a Jeff Nichols movie. I'm always happiest when he's working with Nichols. I think he's tremendous. I think the kid is great in it, and even like small supporting roles like Adam Driver is fantastic in this movie. So yeah, I like this movie a hell of a lot. So yeah.
All right, number four on your list.
All right, number four on my list is a documentary called Not Film that played in LA and New York and is continuing to move across the country. Back in 1965, a now forgotten about short film was made that starred Buster Keaton and was written by Samuel Beckett. Basically, Buster Keaton was completely forgotten about at that time. He was desperate for money, desperate for any sort of paycheck. People came up to him and said, hey, Samuel Beckett, you know, this famous playwright, he's written this like short film script, it's kind of avant-garde, and he's like this hot playwright, you should be in it. So he said, fine. He had no idea what the movie was about. And even when he made it, he still had no idea what the movie was about. And that short film was called Film. Well, a couple years ago, this documentary filmmaker named Ross Lippman became obsessed with this film called Film and wanted to know why it was made, how it came together, and why it had been forgotten about. And so what his movie called Not Film is about is essentially it's kind of like Hearts of Darkness or any of those kind of great documentaries where it's about the making of another movie that was fraught with problems. And what I think is especially terrific about Not Film, and to be clear, I had never seen this short film before. I had no idea that it even existed. And they show it at the beginning so you kind of know, okay, this is what this movie is. And it's no great lost masterpiece. It's really interesting, but it's not amazing or anything like that. But you need to watch it so that when you watch Not Film itself, you can understand what was going on. And what I find incredibly fascinating and moving about this movie is it's, at its core, it's about if you have an amazing talent like Buster Keaton and you have this amazing talent like Samuel Beckett and you still make this thing that doesn't really work and is kind of forgotten about now, what's the point of making things? What's the sort of mystery of people who are talented and are brilliant but don't see eye to eye at all? And then also, if you know, kind of the proverbial, if a tree falls in the forest and nobody hears it, doesn't make a sound, what sort of a legacy does a movie like this have? I don't want this to sound like one of those kind of egg-heady, pretentious, you know, what is the nature of film documentaries. It's much, much, much more fun than that. You hear these great stories. Obviously, both Beckett and Keaton are dead now, so you're hearing stories from other people. But it's just this great sense of play about people coming together, making a movie, and not working out. Like I said, it's still kind of touring around the country, so if you live somewhere in the United States and this sounds interesting at all to you, I highly recommend checking out their website because they do have a running list of the different places it's showing across the country. So Not Film is on my list.
All right. I have not seen it, so we don't really need to discuss this. But you've made a good case. I'm curious to see it now. So there's Not Film. My next movie, my next film on my list is definitely not a short. It is about 8 hours long. It is O.J. Made in America, of course, that I've discussed this film on like three different podcasts now. So I don't know how much more I can say about it. To me, you know, we had a long discussion of it on this podcast. I feel that this is a pretty amazing achievement for it all to be put together the way that it is. The fact that it is as smart and has so many different things to say about not just O.J. Simpson, not just celebrity culture, and not just sports, but race and really where we are as a country, while still being very entertaining and flying by, is kind of a really amazing achievement. When I had first heard about this, I was very excited to see it. I didn't know it was going to be something that would be classified as a movie, but it is. It will be up for the Oscars this year. So yeah, I could not put it on my list. My number five on my list, again, alphabetical order, is O.J. Made in America.
It's right there on alphabetically on my list as well, so I'll just dive in right now. Back in January when this first showed at Sundance, there seemed to be this impression that ESPN Films were really excited about this, that they really thought they had something there. And, you know, you can hear this sometimes and think, well, and it turns out not to be so great. They were right. This is pretty tremendous. And, you know, we talked about this on the previous podcast, but I think it's worth repeating. Not only does it touch everything that you talked about, for me, this is also one of the great documentaries now about the victims of domestic abuse and what they go through and why they cannot escape domestic abuse. We talked about this, but I want to repeat it. I still find one of the most upsetting parts of this movie is when they talk to two of the jurors who were on the O.J. Simpson murder trial, essentially saying that they partly felt like Nicole Simpson. I don't want to say that they thought that she deserved it, but they judged her because she didn't leave a violent relationship. And that in some ways that made them feel less sympathetic to her as the victim of a murder. One of the things I most appreciate about this movie is it makes Nicole Simpson very present in the film. And I think the use of the photos of her, not just at different times when she was abused by O.J. Simpson, but the actual crime scene photos of her after she was murdered, I think that those are not over the line. I think they're absolutely necessary, because I think what is important is that we have to remember who these people were that, let's be honest, O.J. Simpson probably killed. And I think that that is important, because I think that because he is the celebrity and because he is still alive, we think about him more than the victims. I think this movie does a very good job of kind of recalibrating that balance so that we remember both Nicole and Ron Goldman as well.
All right. So now we have our five movies. We're down to each of us to give our last one. I'm certain that this one isn't on your list because we've already discussed it and you didn't like it as much as me. So the last movie on my list is Wiener.
This is the worst. Doing a documentary on my scandal at the time.
This documentary about the failed, much disastrous Anthony Weiner for mayor campaign in 2013. To me, I agree with some of your points. We really don't need to get too much detail about them because I don't want to hear you disagreeing with me again. But I agree with some of your points about how the movie sometimes is a little bit too eager to please, and it has all this great material that it sometimes just wants to show it off a little bit too much. That doesn't change the fact that, man, this movie has a lot of great material. And I joked about, as I said in the piece, I discussed this with John Heilman on the Culture Caucus podcast, and he pointed out, he said, listen, every political documentary wants like one holy shit moment. This movie has like 10. And to me, just as empathetic it is to everyone involved while still just having all this great stuff in it, I find it hard not to to get excited about it. So number six on my list in the last of our first half of 2016 is Wiener.
Yes, and listen, credit is due to the filmmakers, because you can have all that great material and still mess it up. And they don't mess it up. You still have to put it together in a way that's dramatically compelling, and that movie is dramatically compelling. I'll just say that as opposed to O.J. Made in America, where I feel like that movie is absolutely not showy, I do feel like Wiener is a little more showy. But I do like it, and I do think it is very entertaining, and he is such a compelling, tragic figure. It's imminently watchable, that movie. It's intensely watchable and entertaining, that movie.
All right, so let's hear the last one on your list.
Okay, so last, going alphabetically on our lists, is a movie that's somewhat of a documentary. It's mostly a documentary, but there are some scripted parts to it. It's called The Other Side. This is from an Italian-French filmmaker named Roberto Minervini. I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly. This movie is only played in New York at this point. Hopefully it's going to play in LA, and hopefully it's going to play other places as well across the country. They're working on it. This is a film about very poor people in Louisiana. And what the filmmaker did was essentially follow them. And while hanging out with them, filming them, talking to them, would kind of come up with certain pieces in between the moments that he filmed that were either scripted or things that he would suggest or were built around things that they had talked about. The reason why I love this movie so much, there are actually two reasons. Number one, I like Harmony Korine's films. I especially liked Spring Breakers. But one of the problems I have sometimes with his movies is that though they are kind of knee-deep into the lurid weirdness of America, there's also a certain amount of, gee, let's gawk at the weirdos and feel sort of superior to them in his movies. This movie does not do that. What we are watching is a group of people who are sort of being destroyed by drugs and alcohol, a lack of schooling, frankly, not a lot of job options. These are the people that back in 2008, when Obama was on the campaign trail, and he was, you know, the infamous comment he said about people clinging to their guns and religion and like that, talking about the marginalized people in America. And he got a lot of crap about that. Like, how dare he say that people are clinging to their guns and their religion? The Other Side shows those people, and it shows what they're going through. And I found it enormously moving because the movie lets them simply be who they are without either being patronizing or trying to glorify or romanticize their poverty in certain ways. The second half of the film is taken over by a group of people who are basically starting a militia who hate Obama, blow up vehicles to show how much they hate Obama, and talk about what's going on in America and the wrong direction that America is going. I don't think I've seen anything that perfectly encapsulates, oh, this is the anger and this is the frustration that leads people to want to vote for someone like, say, Donald Trump or get involved in the Tea Party. I think that this movie does such a compassionate, sort of clear-eyed job of letting those people kind of have their day in court, honestly. At the same time, I think what we see in the movie is absolutely horrifying in terms of the lives that these people are living. But never once for a second while I watched this did I think I was superior to these people. No, neither did I think I was supposed to be gawking at them and be like, look at the freak show. I think this filmmaker does an exceptional job of just sort of presenting a part of the country that, frankly, we don't see very much at all. I think this movie is pretty terrific. I have a feeling this is going to end up on my top 10 list at the end of the year.
I have also seen The Other Side. It did not make my list. I agree with you pretty much everything that you've said here. Except, I got to tell you, I have a hard part with the scripted idea. There are scenes in this that, it's hard to tell what, it doesn't really tell you what's scripted and what doesn't scripted, or if they redo a couple of scenes. I agree that the movie doesn't gawk, but I also feel like we're seeing a heightened version of these people, which frankly makes me trust it a little bit less.
I don't think that's an unfair statement. It's definitely not a thing where you know, okay, this is definitely real. This is something that's been changed or tweaked or heightened, like you were saying. And I think that's a fair criticism of it. For me, I think what makes me look past that or forgive that is I think that those moments, they don't make me trust it less, only because I think it's all building to the filmmaker's ultimate point, which is let's try and look at these lives as lives as opposed to being a demographic. And so for me, the cheat, if you will, in terms of certain things that it shows that are either scripted or changed or altered, that to me works towards what is ultimately a sympathetic portrayal. I don't think that those things are being used for cheap dramatic effect.
Yeah, but I don't know that. I don't know that, and you don't know that either. Like, we don't know what's real, right? Like, we don't, like, to me, that's the major problem with the movie. And it's, and again, I found it very compelling. I do think it's sympathetic, while also not just letting people off the hook. Like, I think that,
yes.
Yeah, I certainly don't think that it's just like, look, see, they're fine. This is the way that they feel. Respect them now. I really don't think the movie is doing that either. But there's just a ceiling to how far I can go with this movie, because I don't know what's real and what's not. I just don't. Like, I don't want to be all fact-checkery guy, but, like, if I don't know if something's real or not, I don't know if I can, if I'm adequately moved. If you had told me this whole movie was actors, and the whole thing was actors and it was all fake, it would not have the power, which means, obviously, the fact that they're real people has some sort of connection to why we respond to it. But because of that, if I know some of it's heightened, some of it has been heightened, some of it's real, some of it's not real, it's hard for me to give myself all the way over to the movie.
This is sort of like an ongoing issue with documentaries about this idea of, well, what's exactly real, and then therefore, is everything faked, and is everything sort of the perspective of the filmmaker? And so if that's the case, then it's not really a true story or a nonfiction piece. And so this is sort of like this endless and important conversation, but it's like this continuing kind of conversation. For me, I mean, if this was entirely scripted, would I feel the same way about it? It's a completely fair question. I probably would not, but I don't watch this movie feeling like I'm being tricked or that I can't trust it. And I think it goes down to something as elemental as you either buy it or you don't. And I have to admit, I buy it. I buy it as being, in quotes, true, even though certain things may be tweaked. I'm willing to buy that. I think that's a movie like this basically asks that question of you.
Right, so that's fair. All right, so those are the movies. So just to wrap up one last time, the final six. Here are my best six movies of the first half of 2016. Everybody Wants Some, The Lobster, Louder Than Bombs, Midnight Special, OJ Made in America, and Wiener. And Grierson's are, read them off.
Cemetery of Splendor, Everybody Wants Some, The Lobster, Not Film, OJ Made in America, and The Other Side. So we had three in common.
At the end of the year, we will do a super long, extra long podcast where we really dig into all of our top 10. So maybe you'll hear some of these movies on the top 10 at the end of the year. And if you didn't like our discussion or felt it was too short or truncated, worry not, because we're going to dig way in come December when we do all of these. And of course, as we mentioned the last couple weeks of podcast, we've missed some movies. Like, there are some movies that we did not get to. Particularly on my list of movies I wanted to get to and didn't. I didn't get to April in the Extraordinary World. I didn't get to Sing Street. I didn't get to The Fitz. I didn't get to Swiss Army Man or Krisha. Like, there's still a lot of movies I really wanted to see that I was not able to get to. But I've got six more months to get them now.
Yes, if only they weren't making more movies between now and then. And yes, and by the way, April in the Extraordinary World is also on my list of things I did not get to that I really, really wanted to get to. But the good thing about doing these lists is now it already starts the process of going, okay, these are things I need to catch up with.
Yeah, so this is why Decembers are insane, because you're just desperately trying to get to everything. And that's kind of how I felt on this podcast a little bit, because we needed to get to the BFG, which is, after all, Steven Spielberg's new movie, which is the type of thing that we would discuss. And I reviewed it on the site this week. And unfortunately, we just don't have time. We are on a strict time schedule this week, so we are not able to get to that. So, Grierson, some good news, though. Next week, you and I are doing this show in person.
That is right. I'm very excited about that. We'll be in Los Angeles. So yes,
I will be in your new home. I've not seen your new home, so you could like totally pretend it was. You could like go to someone like Bill Murray's house from Zombieland. Just go in there and tell me that's your new home, and I won't even know because I've not seen your place. But we're gonna do this in person next week, and so because of that, we noticed we did not have any reboots this week. Because as you see, this show was so packed already, we didn't have any chances for reboots. So next week we're gonna talk about the BFG. We're gonna get around to the BFG since we did not get to talk about this week. We're also gonna talk about The Secret Life of Pets with Grierson, which Grierson will be reviewing for us this week. And we have three, count them, three reboots. The reason we have three reboots is one of them we're not going to spend very much time on. But the first of our reboots is Face Off, of course, directed by John Woo from 1994?
Seven, I think.
You're right. The other movie's that's right. So that is starring John Travolta, Nicolas Cage, and Face Off. That is Face Off. That's my impersonation of Nicolas Cage saying Face Off in the movie Face Off. Also, we will be discussing Miller's Crossing by the Coen brothers from 1990. We've already discussed one Coen Brothers movie on this podcast, so we might as well get into one of the original early great ones that everybody loves, talking about that. And the last movie we're talking, probably for not very long, but just to get Matt Singer off of our back,
yes,
is we are seeing Jim Cotta, for crying out loud.
And you haven't seen Jim Cotta, right?
I've seen it. We watch it every Christmas. We never miss Jim Cotta.
I've never seen it, so I'm very excited to finally experience Jim Cotta.
Starring Kurt Thomas, Richard I don't know who any of these people are. Directed by Robert Klaus from, I'm not sure what year Jim Cotta actually came out. I'm going to look this up right now. Jim Cotta came out in 1985.
It would not shock me if you told me that Matt Singer was actually in this movie. I know so little about this movie other than the fact that Matt Singer loves it. I'm excited.
And the poster is of a gymnast kicking three ninjas. So, you know. But those were our best films the first half of 2016. To close up for us, Grierson, are you happy with my list? Did you like – I feel like your list – I did think that Midnight Special would be on there, and I did not know about Not Film. But otherwise, I'm not shocked by any of your choices.
Yeah, and likewise. I mean, I did not know that you had seen the Trier film. I'm so glad that you did. Yeah, I think these were good lists. I think these are – and again – there's so many good movies in the first half of the year. So people should not complain. There actually is good stuff out in the first half of the year. They don't just cram it all in the second half.
Absolutely. So, and I think all of these, almost all of these movies, The Lobster is not, and Wiener is not, and Not Film is not, and The Other Side is not, but everything else is available through streaming. Through streaming or through iTunes or so on. So you can actually watch, everybody wants some. Louder Than Bombs, I think that's not quite available. Midnight Special, you can see. OJ Made in America, you can see. Cemetery of Splendor, you can see. And The Other Side, you cannot see. So anyway, go see some of these movies, or just wait a month. It's from the first half of the year. They're coming out eventually. All right, Grierson, good show. We got it in our time frame, and next week we'll do this in person.
I'm very excited. Looking forward to that.
I'm excited for you to see what I have a very specific outfit I wear for all of these podcasts.
Ooh, wow.
That was terrifying. That's not. By the way, I want to have the last thing we do in this podcast. Yes. We're a little over time. Yes. The last thing I want to do in this podcast. This is the final podcast being produced by our great producer, Michaela Lefrak. She is the producer of this podcast along with the Primary Concerns podcast. She is a wonderful. She has saved our lives. The podcast is about to get so much worse because nothing against our next producer, whoever our next producer is, but she is a wonderful producer. She's taking a new gig. And we're very happy for her. We congratulate her, but we are very sad that she will not be our producer.
Yes, thank you very much, Michaela. You will be missed.
You have no idea. Grierson, like, once a podcast, just goes off for, like, 15 minutes of just the most disgusting, awful, vile things that a person could say. And she saves your ass every week.
Yeah, every week I actually rail about Warcraft, and she just cuts that out. Just for the one week we reviewed it, she kept it in. All those other
orcs.
Weeks, though? Yeah, orcs.
Orcs. All right, everyone. We'll see you all next week when Grierson and I do this in person. Yay, on the West Coast. Have a great week, Grierson. I'll see you in a week.
All right, bye.